Get everything for your next project at Menards and save big money. We carry everything to help you breathe easier. Allergen air filters help prevent seasonal allergy symptoms and improve your indoor air quality by capturing microparticles while allowing maximum airflow. Save big on Allergen air filters when you shop at Menards. View the weekly flyer and all of our great deals happening this week on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Coverage varies by plan, view contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If your car is out of warranty, one major repair bill could wipe you out. Just ask Ludacris.
Car breakdowns can wreck your wallet. Without endurance, a worn-out timing belt could cost you $1,700. A busted transmission? That's $4,000 easy. An engine meltdown? $7,000. But if you've got endurance, you could never pay out of pocket for a car repair again. With endurance, your car's most expensive parts are covered. Plus, you pick the mechanic you trust to do the work. With endurance, your rate stays the same no matter how many claims you file.
If your car is under 20 years old, Endurance has you covered with unlimited miles. Plus, your plan includes 24/7 roadside assistance anywhere in the country.
So who's going to pay for your next breakdown? You or Endurance?
Choose the name Ludacris trusts. Endurance. Right now, get $300 off any plan, plus a year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free. All backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get your free quote at endurancewarranty.com. That's endurancewarranty.com.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation. We welcome Dr. Sean Baker to the podcast, carnivore expert and really the founding father for the carnivore movement, which I think is pretty interesting in terms of managing autoimmune disease, making people less fat, which I feel like is the major focus whenever I turn on the news and you start looking at health. Everything is Ozempic, GLP-1s, and how to be less fat. And I think you found an interesting way into it and really just talking about managing high protein diet and getting people really into it. So for those of you that have been living under a rock and don't know anything about the carnivore diet, I decided to have Dr. Baker on to talk a little bit about it, about the origins, and more importantly, how it could potentially help you be a less fat version of yourself and maybe ramp up performance on the side.
Yeah, John. Thanks for having me, John. It's a pleasure chatting, and we've known each other now for a couple of years and have talked on a number of occasions. And yeah, you know, I think this is a very important caveat. I am certainly a proponent for a carnivore diet. I think it has potential for tremendous therapeutic benefit for a lot of conditions, particularly things like autoimmune disease and diabetes, mental health, and some other things that we've seen good success with. You know, it's not certainly for everyone. There are a lot of people that can get healthy in a lot of different ways. You mentioned GLP-1s as a drug route. That is a lifetime subscription for people that don't know that. I mean, it's basically, it's engineered to be something you take for the rest of your life. You know, those people, it's pretty clear the data shows when people come off the GLP-1s, they gain the weight back. So it's not, I don't know if that's the right sustainable solution. Yeah, I mean, you can get lean. You can get lean a lot of ways. I mean, you can get fat on a carnivore diet, believe it or not, you know, depending on how it's implemented. And so it's fun to talk about this stuff. I, like you, I very much like performance. You know, I think what distinguishes people that age well are those that actually get in the gym and take care of themselves. I mean, I think that is probably the biggest lever you can pull, irrespective of what nutritional strategy you subscribe to. I guess, you know, with the caveat being you got enough protein in there to support muscle, you know, muscle growth and muscle lean mass maintenance.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've been playing with recently is, you know, setting BMR, you know, going in and figuring out exactly how many calories you're burning and then basically eating a caloric restriction while keeping a high protein diet. And it's pretty interesting that if you lift weights and you continue to train and got a good aerobic base, like losing lean muscle is kind of difficult. I found, you know, having lifted weights for, geez, pretty, con, you know, pretty heavy for about 35 years that actually, as long as the protein requirement is there, losing lean body mass is damn near next impossible. Like the only way I'm going to be able to shed, 20 pounds of lean body mass is to probably go on some form of vegan diet where you eat once a day and, you know, do drum circles instead of lifting weights. And one of my coaches, I joke with Ben Skitnik, he's like, you know, I think for people that have spent a lifetime lifting weights and performance and eating a high protein diet, the body almost acclimates to it. And it's a pretty interesting thing. But, you know, going through in preparation for this podcast, the amount of interesting like outcomes from people doing a carnivore diet were almost too many to count. I was just kind of scrolling through social media and listening to different people that had, you know, carnivore expert and just kind of like carnivore in their hashtag or in their handles. And the amount of people that have reversed like from eczema and just the amount of autoimmune diseases was almost too much to count. But it's, I'm sure you've seen this from the ground up having first really introduced this about 9 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just in, like we were talking off camera, I was in Montana at an event in Bozeman with a bunch of people from carnivore. And I mean, you know, the number of people that say, look, I've literally put this chronic disease, autoimmune disease, mental health disease, diabetes disease into full remission after trying, you know, and being medicated for you know, many cases, several decades. And so it, you know, I'm still shocked from time to time, you know, that I see these just incredible transformations and things I never thought diet would impact. I mean, there's a condition you may be familiar with. It's called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a genetic connective tissue disorder. And so what happens is people end to have they have really laxity. They have lax joints. They dislocate sublux. You know, skin's all stretchy, and you know it's something that you know really bothers them. You know, and I the first time I saw. It's another physician, by the way, 57-year-old physician, female that was working in the ER, and she said she would start every day with three or four joints dislocated. You know, dislocated ankle, dislocated shoulder. She'd have to pop them back in to start her day. She'd go to the ER. About half the time, her shoulder would fall out of place. She'd have to put that back in while she was working, and that had been her life for several decades. And she went carnivore. Within a month, her joints stopped dislocating, which I still, to this day, fail to understand why that occurs. And I've seen that now happen. Many, probably at least 100 different patients with this condition where this is reversed. So it's interesting. It's unique. There are some studies now that have come out on this, particularly several case series. We're in the midst of doing some interventional trials to, you know, further, you know, because it's interesting when you have all these social media anecdotes and clearly these things are getting better. The question is, how many people does it affect? Is it 50% of the population with the condition? Is it 90%? Is it 5%? We don't know that right now. And so that's been my focus. And, you know, it's the challenge of getting this stuff paid for because they're expensive. And so we've been struggling. But we've successfully now convinced some people to start doing some of these. So we'll have more scientific data on this because one of the criticisms was there's no science and therefore I'm not going to do it. And honestly, I don't think most of us use science to determine what we eat. I mean, I'm not talking about you and I, but I'm talking about the general population. They eat what is cheap and what tastes good. And that's how they make their decisions on food. They don't go to the U.S. guidelines to make their decision making. We know about 86% of the people do not follow the U.S. dietary guidelines. And I don't think they'll continue. Even though I don't know if you're aware, I know that there's going to be a big change in that. I think RFK is going to push for more meat back in the diet, which I think will be good. Good to see because we've demonized it for the last, you know, really 50 years. So turning that around would be, I think, a net benefit just from the protein alone, as you talked about and alluded to earlier.
You know, the thing which always never ceases to amaze me, and I don't know why I like have seen this over the years, is people have these incredible outcomes, right? So they go into a high protein diet, they actually put on some muscle, body composition improves, and there's a direct relationship between the amount of muscle you carry in relation to body fat in terms of metabolic flexibility, right? The leaner you are, the more muscle you can carry is a good indicator of your metabolic health. And I think meat is a cornerstone in that. But then all of a sudden some study comes out where it says, oh, you know, meat causes cancer. It's amazing how many people jump off that ship and instantly start demonizing it. It's almost like meat is in some way some like guilty pleasure that they know is bad. But then when all of a sudden, you know, they have all these positive outcomes, I'm amazed at how quickly people jettison it and like, you know, want to jump on that bandwagon. Never really made much sense to me why, if something is working, why you would be so apprehensive about continuing to do something that works. It's like, you know, like periodically things will come out where they talk about, oh, lifting weights destroys joints. And I'm like, I know that to be the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, I damaged my knee pretty extensively playing football. And the only reason I'm able to do jujitsu and train and do the things I do is because I lift heavy weights. You know, a lot of the, and you're an orthopedic surgeon, a lot of the arthritis that I have in my knee completely abated and actually looks better today on the x-rays and the scans than it did 10 years ago for the fact that I continue to load the joint. And most of the people that I've seen that have arthritis, when they stop loading the joint is when all of a sudden we see this acceleration of a lot of the deterioration of the joints. I think the meat falls into the same category. We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Do you have limited access to equipment and restricted time to train? Let me introduce you to Lean Enable, our bare essentials training program for those lean on time and equipment. Don't let limitations hold you back. Get able-bodied with our adaptive training to tackle the daily demands of life. Head to powerathletehq.com/leanandable and claim your 7-day free trial today. Now back to the show.
Yeah, there is a lot of data out there. It's kind of interesting. 2015, the World Health Organization declared unprocessed red meat as a class 2 carcinogen. Based on mostly observational epidemiologic studies, that position has now been, not by the WHO, but by many, many other well-respected scientific organizations, has basically said that that was a sort of poor conclusion, and most of the data supports basically no effect, basically. The data is so weak around that. And the reality is, when we're looking at cancer, probably a much bigger driver of cancer is obesity. And what happens when you consume a high protein diet consisting of a lot of meat and not a bunch of junk food, you tend to get leaner. That has a much more powerful effect on your risk of cancer, whether it's colon cancer, you know, prostate, you know, breast cancer, whatever it might be. So we have that messed up. And then specifically with the joints, and I think that's an interesting thing, particularly because that's, you know, where I spent most of my career dealing with arthritis with people as an orthopedic surgeon. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things we used to think that loading the joint, you know, was a problem, and we would have this wear and tear stuff, and that, you know, can be an issue. But we also know that arthritis very much is a biologic disease and less so a mechanical disease for most people. Most of the people that I did joint replacements on were obese women in their, you know, 50s, 60s, and 70s. They're not out there lifting heavy weights. They're basically sedentary. They're carrying too much body fat, which is inflammatory. We know that high levels of body fat and also high levels of insulin, for that matter, lead to increased inflammatory cytokines in the joint, which destroy the joint. So I would tell my patients, even after a joint replacement, get out there and strength train, you know, because the muscles around the joint provide the dynamic stability. You know, we have ligaments and the shape of the bones, which provide some sort of, you know, static rigidity or stability of the joint. But when you're going through a range of motion, it's the muscles that keep things on track. It's like, you know, driving around with your tires out of balance. You know, you're going to wear down quicker. If you strengthen the joints, it keeps everything in balance better. And so, you know, it moves as it's supposed to. And, you know, you can, I know, interesting, way back in the day, I remember when I was training for people, we had this paper that was presented to us. It was a German study looking at German Olympic lifters. And what they saw was their patella cartilage, which is the thickest cartilage in our body, actually improved. It got thicker because of the stress put on it. So our cartilage can respond to stress, just like our muscles can. It's a very slow process. This isn't happening in a period of weeks or months. This is many, many years. But over years and years, I do think you can, you know, induce some positive benefits on the cartilage itself by strength training.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. So for people that, you know, hear carnivore diet, right? Like a meat-based diet, but like, what does that realistically look like? Like what's a realistic carnivore versus kind of an ideal carnivore? And like, what do you eat and what do the different, I guess you could say, segments? Because I felt like there was like traditional carnivore and like people had these kind of interesting varying, like some people were, you know, cheese, more eggs. It's, it felt like there was a couple different factions in there. I was curious to know what your diet looks like. And more importantly, like what are these different versions and how people are kind of skinning this?
Yeah. So, I do think that there is some utility in adjusting things. Like for instance, I think people with central nervous system issues, whether it's a neurodegenerative disease like multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, early dementia, or even mental health disorders like depression, anxiety, bipolar, so on and so forth, those people tend to fare better on a higher fat, almost a ketogenic version of this. So you're going to emphasize a lot of fat. You know, it's going to be obviously ideally you're going to get that fat from animal sources, you know, eggs, beef, you know, fish. Some people add dairy if they tolerate that. That works well for them. I think people that are more concerned with maybe metabolic issues like weight loss and prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, some of those people will do better with a little bit more focus on protein and a little bit less fat. Now, fat becomes, and when I say, I don't want to say low fat because no version of carnivore is low fat because you're not consuming effectively any carbohydrates. You know, maybe a little bit if you consume a lot of dairy. Eggs have a tiny amount. You know, every egg has about a half a gram of carbohydrates, but it's insignificant. So in those cases, so for instance, if I were to look at the fat by calorie, most people exist between 60% of their calories coming from fat and 80% of their calories coming from fat. Some people go a little bit higher. That is clearly a high fat diet. You know, average American is consuming around 30% of their calories from fat, you know, 15% protein, and then the rest comes from carbohydrates. And so, but yeah, there's different ways to do it. I mean, there's obviously, the nice thing about carnivore as opposed to things like keto and paleo and vegan diet, it's hard to put junk food in there. You know, it's just, you see all these processed products, you know, oh, I'm going to eat something that's keto and it's just pure garbage, right? It says keto on the label or it says paleo on the label or vegan on the label and it's just absolute crap for you. So it's really a whole food diet, you know, one of the ones that it's, you know, very difficult to not do that. So that's part of the benefit. And a lot of people will say, hey, it's just because you're cutting out the processed food that the benefit is here. And no doubt that makes a difference. However, you know, what I do see is people that are already on a pretty clean diet and they'll drop vegetables, believe it or not, and their symptoms get better. And I know that blows people's minds, but it's just what I see on a regular basis. And I'm not necessarily saying that's something you have to do for life. Some people prefer it that way. I'm a guy, I never really cared for vegetables. I never liked them as a kid. I never liked them as an adult. I forced myself to eat them. I don't eat them anymore. I don't force my kids to eat them. If they want to eat them, they can eat them. If a kid says, hey, I want some carrots here, I'll get you some carrots. But I think the focus, again, one of the problems initially with a ketogenic diet, I felt, was that it was under protein for a lot of people. And as you know, particularly as an athlete, you need protein for performance. And perhaps in a low carb state, you might even need more than someone in a higher carb situation. So it might be you're looking at, you know, a gram per pound or, you know, some of the studies out there suggest 2.6 per kilo if you're into bodybuilding and stuff like that. So, I mean, much more than the RDA, which is abysmal, 0.8, you know, grams per kilo. And I've seen some studies will suggest 1.2 to 1.6. And I do, we don't have a lot of data on these low carb diets and protein requirements. There's some studies suggest that, for instance, endurance athletes should increase it a bit more than that. And so, you know, we'll see what plays out with time. But I can tell you, if your goal is putting on muscle, you better be eating a lot of protein, regardless of your diet, particularly if you're on a carnivore diet.
So for you, how do you skin it? I mean, is it just go to Costco and buy as much ribeye and different cuts, or is it something where you get a cow? Like, I'm just curious. I do like your social media strategy of sitting there with a big knife on a cutting board, eating a steak while people espout pretty much the exact opposite of what you're doing by consuming it. So I definitely got a lot of laughs out of that, but so I feel like, for me, I mean, You know, I mean, it's probably the curse of the gifted in a lot of ways, but like, we've always eaten steaks. Like I was telling my kids that when I was in college, my roommate had this Weber barbecue, and we used to live next door to a supermarket. And the guy who was the meat cutter liked to have a few drinks on his break, and he couldn't sit out and, you know, do it in his car. So he ended up kind of sitting on our stoop. And one day we ended up meeting the guy and just said to him, "Hey man, you're more than welcome to come in here and drink beers on our couch or whatever you want to do." Next thing you know, we went in there and he's like, "Hey, I got some stuff for you." And he was like handing us all the day old meat. So we ended up pretty much just backing into a carnivore diet for the fact that we made friends with the butchers at Andronico's Market in Berkeley. But up until that point, you know, my roommate grew up in Central California and would, you know, was a 4-H guy and raised animals. And so he would just come in and we would like just basically, it's all we ate was steaks at that point. So that's kind of been part of my, I guess just really just part of my diet for a number of years. So it's interesting to meet people that don't eat meat. And like seeing you eat there, I'm like, "Oh, it looks pretty good. You got a big knife. You're eating that." But I'm interested to know some of the comments or some of the hate that people send your way. Because I feel like that's very anti what most people are used to.
Yeah, well, I mean, to answer your original question, yeah, I mean, I went to a local rancher. I got a side, you know, half a beef. I get, you know, fortunately, well, I mean, luckily for me, I get a lot of ranchers just send me their meat because I'm, you know, eat it on social media and they get advertised and they usually sell beef. So it works out pretty well. So I you know, and then I'll go to Costco from time to time and buy it. And I think this is important. This is an important part. You can get healthy eating beef from Costco supermarkets. It's not some, you know, you have to have only this regeneratively raised grass finished meat to get healthy. That's just not the reality. You know, at least not what I see on a daily basis. Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, obviously, you know, if you take an extreme controversial position, particularly in this day and age with everybody having access to social media and all the anonymity that comes with it, you know, you can hide behind a keyboard and hurl insults, you know, and, you know, I mean, some of it comes from the people that are plant-based and they feel that it's an ethical violation for me to eat the way that every human since the dawn of man has eaten, which I think is totally bizarre. You know, these people that are sort of sold their, they've kind of identified themselves as these protector of the animals and they don't even understand the reality of you know, what it entails to consume food. I mean, you know, irrespective of what you choose to put in your mouth, there are, you know, just untold millions, billions, trillions, and even quadrillions of lives that are killed because of that. The food system requires death. When I die, I will be food for something, as will you, as will all of us. And so I don't have any big ethical concerns about eating an animal. You know, and then, you know, and of course there's people that you know, often criticize me because they're like, "Well, you don't have to eat a carnivore diet to be in shape." And I've never said that. I just say, this is my particular preference. And as a physician, and again, this is where I really my goal as a physician is to heal people, you know, and that's what I'm trying to get out there. And if you can heal yourself on a vegan diet, good for you. I'm happy for you. I happen to have some level of specialization and expertise in this particular strategy for healing people. And I think it's very effective. And in my view, it may be one of the most effective nutritional ways to heal disease. Now, does that differ from what a healthy person might need or require? Yes, it does. And so it's a very different discussion. So some people conflate that I'm saying that all humans would do better on a carnivore diet, which I'm not saying that. But so they'll criticize me about that, saying, "Oh, you're stupid. You could just eat a whole food diet, cut out junk food, and you would be just as good." And that may or may not be true for me or other people. And so, yeah, I mean, there's that. I mean, it's you know, and again, as your profile grows, I'm sure you get people that are critical of what you do, you know, in some ways. And you just say, "Okay, whatever." You know, if you want to waste your time on that stuff, go for it.
I feel like not every flavor is everybody's flavor, right? Like there's 31 flavors when you go to the ice cream. Baskin Robbins, 31 flavors. Not that you're a big ice cream guy, but like there's a lot of different flavors in there. And for the most part, I like chocolate and vanilla, and there's a million different options. So I think in terms of, let me see how I couch this in an interesting way. I'll actually go back to a conversation I had with Rob years ago where we were talking about longevity. And he felt that the greatest recipe for longevity was training for athleticism and some of the stuff we do at Power Athlete. He's like moving through space, lifting heavy weights, being dynamic, you know, central nervous system efficiency, post-activation potentiation, a lot of these different things where you're asking people to not only, you know, move heavy weights, but move a lighter weight fast, you know, a lot of, you know, moving through space and then actually taking the training and then using it in a meaningful way. Let's say it's, you want to do jujitsu, you want to box, you want to do anything. So for me, training and lifting weights and more importantly, like strength training, whether it be fitness-based, performance-based, is about freedom and the ability to do the things that you want to do. I look at diet much in the same way. The diet that I have and the diet that I should follow should allow me to be the best version of myself so that I'm able to have the most amount of freedom. And whether that be a carnivore diet or whatever, like, you know, the problem is I haven't met very many people that were plant-based vegans that were extremely impressive looking and just physically imposing that weren't consuming like 500 or 600 grams of protein through some plant-based source and taking performance enhancing drugs. Like all the bodybuilders that I've seen that are like, oh, we're plant-based. If you look at how many grams of protein they're consuming, because you think about the nutrient density and just the bioavailability of the protein, they're going to have to consume more. So it's like 400 or 500 grams of protein and some performance enhancing drugs for, to upload, you know, protein synthesis. I have yet to meet somebody who ate a high protein diet like we're discussing that lifted weights that didn't look the part to some degree, but there were, you know, as I was going through, like I said, in preparation for this, I did run into a few people that kept talking about the carnivore didn't work for me. And I thought that was such an interesting thing, you know, one of which was Mark Bell's brother, you know, Chris Bell talked about like somehow carnivore failed him. And, that was such an interesting comment because of the fact that it's such a basic deal. I mean, you know that if, you know, macronutrient or protein, I mean, what does it look like? It's just, it's interesting that I was able to find people that it had completely altered their life. And there were a few people that were saying it didn't work for them. And I was more confused by that one. And I was hoping you could shed some light on maybe some of the issues that people run into where maybe they feel that carnivore has failed them or didn't work for them.
Yeah, and Shane, I've got Mark coming to the house today. We're going to work out together. So it's kind of funny that you mentioned Chris. And Chris has been a friend of mine for many, many years. And I think, you know, and I guess it the question is, what do you mean it didn't work for you? So a lot of people, like Chris, when I first met him, he was in a really bad place. He had just got out of rehab, was really just physically not a very good place. He did carnivore for a number of years, and it actually improved him. So there was some improvement that he got. And I think it changed his relationship with food in many ways. And then, you know, ultimately, I think that a lot of people will use a carnivore diet to reset things, to improve things. And then they may move on to something else as their goals change. Or, you know, sometimes, and again, some people just don't like the boredom. I mean, it's just like, you know, hey, I want to eat all these other foods, these other delicious foods that are out there. And I get that. You mentioned, you know, ice cream. I do from time to time eat ice cream. I'll make it out of egg yolks and cream, and I might add a little vanilla in there and make vanilla, and it tastes friggin' delicious, you know. Maybe add some monk fruit to that, and I can eat that, and it's you know, it's effectively. I'm not a like religious zealot about this stuff, and so I can eat steak and ice cream all day and stay lean and be pretty happy with that diet.
Pretty good diet, dude. I'm not mad at steak and ice cream.
Yeah, it's not a bad diet, you know. I mean.
Well, the one thing my wife does make fun of me about is she's like, how are you always this happy to eat a steak? Yeah. She's like, it's as if every steak you cook is the best steak that you're going to have. And I'm like, I've just never gotten tired. I mean, like chicken, I absolutely hate chicken. Like the thought of eating chicken to me is like more like a punishment. Yeah. Fish I do enjoy, especially if it's cooked well. We went to this place that did like where they cook the whole fish at once. I mean, and I kind of dig stuff like that, pulling it off of the bone. It feels very primal to me. But like for a steak, I, as long as I'm cooking it and it's cooked well, I'm ecstatic about it. And I think that's a good indicator that I've never gotten tired. Whereas my wife is like, I just get tired of chewing steak. Yeah. And I was like, those words have never crossed my mouth or sorry, my mind. And I wonder if there's like a male female component to that. Whereas maybe women get, you know, need a little more variety. They get tired of chewing meat. Whereas, man, I cannot think of anything I'd much rather be doing more than eating a steak.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there is a little dichotomy between men and women. I think, you know, I think some of that has to do with different energy requirements. Women are fatter than men, just biologically, they carry a little more body fat than we do. So I think there, I think their menstrual cycle does, you know, change their energy requirements. So some women do struggle with that. But I mean, back to people saying, well, the diet didn't work. Sometimes it's just a misunderstanding of laboratory data, because they'll say like, it didn't work for me because my creatinine went up. And you have to explain to them that an elevation in serum creatinine in a person that works out, that eats a lot of protein, and particularly if someone has a lot of muscle, is actually a more or less a normal finding. And so people don't understand that. Their doctors don't understand that. They tell them, stop eating so much protein, you know, go see it's just a lack of knowledge based on that part. Some people say, well, their cholesterol went up. And again, this is another thing that's a very controversial topic, but there is some physiology that we understand around that may not indicate a failure. So it's some of that, but I mean, some people legitimately just don't feel very good on it. And I get it. Maybe, it's a social thing. It is a habit thing. You know, there are people that are, you know, honestly addicted to garbage, and they just don't want to give that stuff up. But I do think legitimately there are people that have had, you know, it's interesting. I had a woman out there that she's always, you know, chirping in my feed about she had heart disease, you know, after being on a carnivore diet for 9 years, and she's like in her mid late 70s. And it's like, well, you probably would have gotten heart disease anyway. I mean, this is one of those things that people just, you know, they just sort of don't understand some of the general physiology there, or they had it pre-existing and it just, you know, continued over time. And it might have, you know, presented itself 5 years earlier had you been on something different, perhaps. But I mean, I certainly would say that, yes, there's people where, and I tell people, hey, try for 3 months. You know, if it works well, great. Press on and do it till it continues to work. And I personally, if it stopped working well for me, I would do something else. I'm not married to this thing. So you do it. And again, this is why I focus on sick people, because, you know, if you're healthy and everything's going well, hey, don't fix what, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Right. Why would you change anything? Right. Like you're, I assume, doing well on what you're doing. Keep pressing on until it no longer works. That's how I would approach things. But,
I've always taken like a cyclical approach to my diet. Like I feel like in the winter months when things are a little colder, I tend to eat a little more steak, a little more protein. I think when the summer months happen, I tend to eat a little bit more carb. I've always kind of subscribed a little bit to that. And that might be some of the paleo influence, but I agree with you. Like the paleo thing, when it was originally explained to me by a guy named Mauro De Pasquale, you know, and it was based off of the Vince Guaranda's Stone Age diet, was where I first kind of heard it. And then obviously translate that into like kind of Rob and Lauren Cordain. It always made sense from a lot of just like the performance side of it. And I always felt like, you know, the more protein in my diet, the more muscle I was able to put on, you know, and then just kind of managing carbohydrates. But that cyclical ketogenic kind of like cyclical kind of carb diet, I think, has always been a pretty good approach. So I never felt that eating a carnivore diet was much of a stretch. And whenever people have asked me, I always tell them the exact same thing. Like, give it a try. Like, try it for 30 days, which is how we do everything.
Are you a financial advisor considering the Independent Registered Investment Advisor, or RIA, model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. Schwab has helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Navigate the big and small decisions by tapping into Schwab's decades worth of insights on what fuels RIA success. With Schwab Advisor Services, you have a custodian that will support you every step of the way. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission, or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust. Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Like, you know, I remember when, you know, I got a bunch of blood testing done and I had a gluten sensitivity. The doctor's like, pull bread out, pull out all these things. And it was amazing how much inflammation decreased in my body and how much joint pain went away. Just, it was like I woke up one day and like my joints didn't ache the same way. So then that's kind of what got me down a lot of this rabbit hole of figuring out maybe some of the systemic inflammation that I was getting from playing football was being exacerbated through the diet. And you just kind of get in this fact-finding mission and finding out what works for you. Unfortunately, I feel like most people just want a carbon copy answer. Hey, doc, you're the carnivore doc. Should I do carnivore? Which I'm sure you answer every single day. And it probably goes back to like, what do you want out of it? And more importantly, are you willing just to give it a try and give it an honest try and then make an honest assessment? And then I feel like probably people either go yes or no and you get some pretty good results. Are there any like interesting adaptation phases for people that are early into it? Like I remember early in that keto thing, Rob talking about like keto flu, where people were losing electrolytes and not using enough salt. And that was a key factor. But do you see any like interesting adaptations or changes in those first 30, 60 days?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, you see people where they will often develop the same thing with electrolytes, you know, as your insulin level, you know, dropping carbs from your diet will reliably bring your insulin down somewhat. I mean, you still stimulate it with protein. And some people, actually, there's studies out there show that fat actually stimulates insulin, about 10% of the population, it would seem. But, you know, as the insulin falls, you lose electrolytes. Your kidneys no longer hold on to as much sodium, so you just kind of pee off everything. So you have to make sure you stay hydrated. That's one thing. Obviously, this is a diet, and this is very controversial. It doesn't have any fiber in it. There's no fiber in this diet. And so you are literally going to go to the bathroom less. You're just not going to be wasting as much stuff. I mean, there's just not as much there. So people will sometimes be it's disconcerting, you know, going from, you know, sitting on the toilet two or three times a day to once every 3 days for some people, depending on how much they eat. So that people get a little concerned about that. And it's generally not a real concern for most people. I think that, you know, depending on where you're coming from, if you're coming from a place where you're very, very much dependent on carbohydrates, and maybe you're sick and you're, you know, you're insulin resistant and you just have to, you know, slam in that carbohydrate to keep the glucose levels up, or to make them effective, I should say, because your glucose is high, but your cells can't use it, then you may struggle with energy. And a lot of people do. They struggle with energy until they sort of get used to the new fuel source. And it takes a while. I mean, enzymes have to be upregulated. DNA expression for different cell types has to occur. Different cell types, you know, switch over in the gut. So there is a period of time from anywhere from about 3 to 8 weeks for most people. For athletes, it can take a lot longer. For people that are intense athletes, you know, depending on the sport, it might take as much as 6 months to fully adapt to it. And so that's why a lot of people, they're like, it's not worth it, man. I wouldn't do it in season. If you're playing, you know, playing ball somewhere in the middle of the season, I'd wait till the end of the season and try it. There's a couple NFL guys that tried it over the years and had some pretty good success with it, you know, that I contacted. One other thing, and the other point you brought up, which I think is interesting, is a discussion around inflammation. Because as an old guy, and I'm very close to 60 years of age right now, and I still push hard. I mean, I think that's what you got to do to age well. I'm out there trying to run fast and jump high and do all those things. I had to lean down a little bit to make that happen. But the fact that I have less inflammation allows me to train more regularly. And as you know, over time, you know, regular training over time consistently yields results. I could dump some carbs in there, maybe have a one-off better workout perhaps, but then I pay for it with some level of inflammation, which then makes the next day's workout maybe not even doable. So for me, it's a calculation. You know, I'm a master's athlete guy. I'm not competing at the highest level in the NFL or in the Olympics or anything like that. Where, I, you know, and again, this is, as you know, this is the 1% of the 1% of the 1% people. So it's not really relevant for you know, almost everyone on planet Earth except for a few freaks.
Since Mark Bell's showing up to train with you today, I was wondering if I could get a little commentary on the sugar diet.
Absolutely, yeah.
A bunch of questions on it, and I thought at first Mark was just being contrarian, like mm-hmm. just playing the heel, like a WWF guy. You know, he did the war on carbs, and then he came back with the sugar diet. So I figured maybe he was just switching sides, like Hollywood Hogan. But he seems to have really dug in on this, and one of the caveats that I kind of go back to is high sugar diets are negatively affect the microbiome, which is pretty well proven. And the reason I know this is my son's a type 1 diabetic. And so we get a lot of, we've done a lot of microbiome work with Dr. Hazan, who's been on the podcast, and my wife and I have gotten it done. And it's just, it's pretty interesting where she talks about, like, you know, showing you different diets of people that eat westernized diets, high sugar diets, and just seeing like the markers within the microbiome, how it's not very favorable. So I'm curious to see how this whole thing pans out. I mean, in the intermediate, you drop a bunch of, you know, protein, a bunch of fat out of there and eat a bunch of carb, you probably shed a little bit of muscles. So I just am interested to see how this pans out, and more importantly, what the long-term results of just going to the sugar diet are.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly, I mean, well, let me just talk about, you know, we do see people losing weight, and Mark has gotten lean, and other people have gotten lean doing that. And I did a version of the sugar diet, but basically just doing it with fat. I mean, the real driving metabolic factor is this so-called FGF21, fibroblast growth factor 21, which is upregulated in very low protein states. So if you take it to the absolute extreme, there's a condition called kwashiorkor. These are these skinny kids in Africa with the big bloated bellies and emaciated arms. These kids, this is a protein malnutrition state. They're not calorie restricted. They've got enough calories, by the way. These kids are eating, you know, 1,500, 2,000 calories a day of corn and maize and cassava and whatnot, but very, they have access to no protein, basically. And so they become emaciated. Now, why it affects kids more than adults, kids are in this rapid growth phase. And they have, literally, there is, they can't just, I'm going to eat protein one day. There's none for them. So what Mark is doing is he's, you know, he's doing sugar, he's limiting protein, and then he'll occasionally put some protein back in there, maybe at night in a small amount. And so that low protein state drives, your body literally thinks it's starving. You're not getting lysine, you're not getting leucine, you're not getting branched chain amino acids. So the body says, we're starving, mobilize everything. This is what happens. And so you see this upregulation and uncoupling of mitochondria. So you do lose weight, and you can do that by restricting protein, you know. And again, is that a good long-term strategy for what we've talked about? Probably not. All right. Doing it as a short-term fix to get really lean. Yeah, you can do that. And we see what, like, you look at fruitarians, and these fruitarians, outside of some that, you know, maybe supplement protein and perhaps take performance enhancing drugs, what does a fruitarian typically look like? They're skinny. They're skinny fat. They have their stick people, very, very thin over time. Obviously, Mark's smart enough not to do that. He's gonna probably continue his protein intake to a level that will prevent that from going on. But as far as, you know, negative, so certainly one thing I'd be concerned about is dental health. We know unequivocally that high sugar diets rot your teeth. I mean, that is clear. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily the sugar itself, but it's the strep mutans, which coats our mouth. It's the bacteria in the mouth, which feed on the sugar. So you better be cleaning your teeth, you know, after every single meal religiously.
We deal with this because the way that you treat type 1 diabetics low is with these glucose tabs.
Yeah.
And so when my son goes low, especially in the night, we give him these glucose tabs. And attention towards dental care for him is ramped up exponentially. Like, we take him to the dentist. He goes probably every 6 weeks. It's water pick. He's got to brush his teeth. I mean, like, the amount of gargling, I mean, I don't know if people realize, I guarantee people don't know shit about type 1 diabetes. And so it kind of irks me a little bit where people start using a type 1 diabetes research to kind of like be able to kind of sell what they, like, a model for healthy people. But in terms of like managing lows and just seeing what the glucose and like how we've been having to combat that with his, and he's nine, with his own, you know, dental cases, it makes me not want to consume a sugar diet for the fact that, like, I just see what he has to deal with. And I'm like, man, you're going to have to brush your teeth five times a day, water pick. I mean, you're going to have to manage your gums. It's definitely something to worry
about.
Well,
I mean, for a type 1 diabetic, a sugar diet would put them in DKA. I mean, their blood glucose would be 400 or 500, and they would be in DKA. They'd be in the hospital probably. I mean, you know, there may be some people that could maybe mitigate that somewhat. But I mean, or a poorly controlled diabetic, anyone on insulin, gosh. There is actually, believe it or not, and I'm going to talk to Mark about this. There's a group out there. These are these vegan guys that were advocating for essentially a sugar diet for diabetics, called Mastering Diabetes. And you may, obviously, when you're
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. And so what they find is that if you eat a huge amount of carbohydrates, your body gets a little bit more efficient at using. You can use a slightly less insulin because you've gotten sort of trained to that. But the results are, you know, maybe they'll get their hemoglobin A1C down into the sixes on some of the top people. But you compare that to a lower carb approach where you, I mean, Richard Bernstein, I don't know if you know Richard Bernstein, he just passed away recently.
We follow a Bernstein protocol for my son.
So Bernstein has type 1 diabetics with A1Cs in the fives and fours, right? And so that is a normal level, which prevents all these complications, at least in theory. So I think there's, you know, like I said, I think for you know, as I mentioned, there's a lot of ways to lose weight. You know, is a sugar diet the best way to do it? I mean, for a few people, it might be appealing, you know, because you can eat, you know, junk food. You just eat, well, I mean, you can eat fruit and sugar, basically. And some people might find that to appeal to them. I suspect over the long term, just as some people say they couldn't do meat all the time, there are some people say that I just get tired of eating fruit and sugar all day long. I mean, you know, at some and you may be the same way as me. It's like if I go more than a day or so without a steak, man, I just want a steak. I'm just like, damn, I need this because it's going to be viscerally, primitively satisfying to me. And so sugar might be fun.
I don't think I've gone. Man, since I was 18, I don't think I've eaten red meat almost every single day, mm-hmm. if not multiple times a day since I was probably 18 or 19 years old. Yeah. You know, growing up, like we ate a lot of carbs. I mean, we bred, you know, it was breakfast cereal, banana, non-fat milk, and then it was probably turkey sandwiches or peanut butter and jelly. And then for dinner, we probably had hamburgers. So like maybe steak or like some form of red meat or chicken once a day or maybe twice a day. But for the most part, since I actually started, I guess you could say taking care of myself, let's say at 18, 19 years old when I lived on my own, and then obviously it accelerated once I got to the NFL and I remember I went into the grocery store and I realized I could afford to buy all of the meat underneath the counter. You know, you go from being a broke college kid to, you know, all of a sudden one day you're a millionaire and you're like, oh man, I could actually buy all of these steaks. So I've eaten some form of red meat, if not ground or something. I mean, every single day for, you know, since I was, I mean, almost, what's that, 30 years. I subscribe to it. It's just interesting, like I said, that, if you look at even you go back to like the Art Devaney evolutionary fitness and you look at Art's original kind of work, which I think, you know, influenced Rob and Cordain and a lot of these guys. I mean, this is how our people, like this is, from an evolutionary model, this is how we've eaten. I mean, I don't know if you saw the deal with the Neanderthals with where they were having these bone pits, where they were basically cooking
fat
down.
Factories.
The fat factories.
Yeah.
I mean, like there is fingerprints of this through evolution and all of a sudden get into a situation and where now all of a sudden people are kind of eschewing it is just seems insane to me.
Well, there's a really nice paper that was written by a guy named Mickey Bendor, Rafi Sertoli, and Raina Barca out of Mickey's in Tel Aviv, and they looked at sort of like about 25 different converging lines of science, everything from fossil records to radioisotope data to bioenergetics to genetic testing and so on and so forth. And their conclusion was that humans were largely carnivorous up until about 80,000 years ago. And then what happened was, you know, we started to overhunt our supply of food. These big megafaunal animals became relatively less scarce as the human population expanded in size. And so we had more people and less big animals to eat. So then we were forced to develop range technology. So bow and arrows came in around 80,000 years ago. So we learned how to hunt antelope, which are much leaner. And so because of that, and we didn't have the fat percentage, that's why a lot of people on a carnivore diet prefer the fat. We had a supplement with carbohydrates. So then we started, you know, gathering more and then eventually farming, you know, around 12, 15,000 years ago, we went to farming. And when that occurred, humans as a species became just, you know, and it's very clear in the fossil records, became weaker. We became, our teeth became worse. Our bones became more fragile. We lost about 6 inches in height. Our brain size shrunk around 200 cc's. And so there was a, you know, dramatic shift in who we were as a species. I think there's a population called the Gravettians who lived in Central Europe, 50 to 100,000 years ago. They were on average about 6'2", based on what they can estimate. Again, there's some imprecision in this because it's anthropology, archaeology stuff. which is among the tallest people that walk the planet today. You know, I think population of like the Netherlands and Central, I think Croatia have some of the tallest people in the world right now, at about 6'2". And some of the Nilotic Africans, some of the tribes around the Nile and Africa, have some pretty tall people like the Maasai, Dinka, and some of those folks. And so, yes, I mean, I think there is a very strong historical and evolutionary context in which meat was critical to our development. You know, like I see these people talking about, you know, there's other primates, there's monkeys, gorillas, chimpanzees who've been swinging around in trees for 25 million years eating the same damn food. And if fruit would have made us evolutionarily a bigger brain, it would have happened by then, because they've been eating that. That's their diet, and they don't grow. It wasn't until 3 million years ago when, you know, the climate changed and the tropical forest dried up and it turned into savanna, that, you know, there was a decision being made. You know, what is this new species going to do? And some of us, Paranthropus robusti and Boisei decided to go vegan, and they became extinct because the environment wouldn't support it. They just died out, and then the human species evolved into better and better hunters. I mean, you think about it. We hunt and have killed shark, cow, lion, monkey, other humans. We've eaten everything. Every animal on the planet we have eaten. There's no other species that can make that claim.
Well, and even though there are some hunter-gatherer tribes that do eat a high amount of carbohydrate, I think like the Catawba Indians eat, you know, roots and tubers, and, you know, something like 40 to 50, 60% of their diet comes from carb. If you also look at where they are in the world, it's very sun dependent. So one of the things I work with a couple Brazilians, you know, some of the top Brazilian jiu-jitsu players in the world. And when they moved from Brazil, the diet that they ate in Brazil was kind of making them lunchy, like a little more fat. And so they were like, you know, in Brazil, we eat, you know, rice and beans, and these guys all stay pretty lean. And I ended up pulling a paper on vitamin D levels, that there's a direct relationship between sun exposure, vitamin D levels, and carbohydrate consumption. So the closer you get around the equator and you look at the hunter-gatherer tribes, they ate more carb. The farther you get away, obviously way less carb, you know, like when you get into Alaska. But one of the things that we had to do with them is get their vitamin D levels tested and start supplementing with vitamin D, but then also cut back the carbohydrate a little bit and said, dude, you're not living in Brazil around the equator anymore. You're not in Florianopolis and San Luis. So now that we're here, we have to, you know, tailor the diet a little bit. And it was interesting when we dropped the carb and started upping the vitamin D supplementation, they all leaned out again. So I also think too, when you look at some of the carnivore guys, like, you know, Paul Saladino, you know, he all of a sudden moves to Costa Rica and now he eats more carbs. So I wonder, at some point we'll figure out there's a relationship between sun exposure and probably carbohydrate consumption.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I, as a jiu-jitsu guy, I'm sure you're familiar with Hodger Gracie, and Hodger went carnivore. He consulted me a few years ago, and he's obviously, you know, grew up in Brazil, now lives in England. And he said he went carnivore, and it totally made a huge difference for him from a performance standpoint. He said, I get stronger easier. I feel better. I have less inflammation. And, you know, he's retired from competitive competition, but he still teaches and trains all the time. And he's just like, this is the best I've felt in years. Now, I haven't talked to him in a while. Maybe he switched back to something else. But that is, I do think there's something to that, that, you know, you think about it, particularly like if you live in a cold climate, guess what you got to do? You got to produce more body heat. Right. Yeah. I mean, you just have to, because you're cold. I mean, obviously, we live in modern times now, and we have air conditioned, heated homes. And so it's a little less of an issue. But I mean, you know, throughout most of history, not everybody had central air and central heat. And you know, if you're living in a cold climate, not only what's available to you, there's not tropical fruits in Canada. I'm sorry. They're just not. And the odds of you getting strawberries in January in Saskatchewan is not likely. What could you get? You could find an elk or a caribou, probably. And so that would be a majority of your calories in food. And I think the thing is, it's interesting. Humans are the most geographically diverse species on planet Earth, you know, as far as mammals and animals go. I mean, we exist in every single environment there is, from the tops of mountains to the beach and everything in between. And what we consistently do is we find animals we can eat in all those locations. There are no plants that grow everywhere. There's no, like, you must eat this magic berry to be a human being. As long as you got animals around, you can survive and thrive and live. And some people do it exclusively on animals. And we've seen that historically throughout different factions of the world. You know, this diet seems really, really bizarre in 2025 in America, because we have such an abundance of variety in food, which realistically never existed throughout most of humanity. If you were to go to rural Mongolia 100 years ago, I mean, a carnivore diet would be like, yeah, it's Tuesday, it's every day. You know, it's like, this is what we do all the time. So now it's just weird because, you know, we live in a place where you got, you know, bright blue colored Captain Crunch flavored maple syrup, which is like, you know, what the hell is that stuff? So it's interesting.
Yeah, no, if you read any of the historical accounts of how Genghis Khan fed his army, they would slaughter animals, right? They would take this, like, you know, like a big, like, slab, they throw it on the horseback and then throw the blanket on and ride and then use the sweat to cure the meat and then basically lift the blanket and carve it. And then, you know, obviously dairy that they would bring for, you know, goats or whatever they had. But it was pretty much meat and dairy. And I even think about, like, think about how dynamic and robust their immune system was. The fact that they could consume meat that was being cured on a horse that they're riding under a, like, some form of, like, leather wool blanket. Those guys must have been so robust and so dynamic and like fucking durable. Pretty amazing. Doc, we're actually coming up to a little bit expiration of our time, and I did want to hit you with a little bit of myth busting. So one of the number one myths that we get with the carnivore diet is it's nutritionally deficient. But based on the research that you've done and probably your own testing, it doesn't feel like that. Like, we aren't seeing people with scurvy and some of these other things where their teeth are falling out, but it doesn't feel like it's leading to nutrition deficiencies.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, historically, like specifically with scurvy, we've known for well over 150 years that fresh food, regardless, meat, fruit, vegetables, was preventive and curative of scurvy. We've got that from the polar explorers. They knew that if they got access to fresh meat, their scurvy would be cured. So meat has, for whatever is in there, and there is a small amount of vitamin C, there's probably, I think it's something like 10 grams per pound. Quite a small amount, but it's there. It prevents that. I mean, also we have to realize that our requirements, our vitamin mineral requirements, vary based on our baseline diet. And for instance, things like, for instance, if you eat a lot of phytic acid, which you see in things like legumes and grains, it dramatically increases your zinc requirements. And so we see all types of these types of things. But at the end of the day, are we seeing clinical signs of deficiency? By and large, we're not seeing any. We're not seeing scurvy. We're not seeing, you know, some people say manganese deficiency. We're not seeing folate deficiencies present themselves clinically. Now, I have seen, this is interesting, I've seen, like, for instance, some people will run relatively low folate in their blood, you know, to the point where it's low normal or even below the normal threshold, and yet they have no symptoms of any kind of folate deficiency. And we've seen that, you know, if you go back to some of the historical evaluations they did back on the Eskimos, you know, when they called them Eskimos in the 1920s, now Inuit is the preferred term. But they, you know, there was a study out of, I think it was out of Labrador up in Canada, it might have been in Greenland as well. They looked at two groups of population. One was, and this is around vitamin D, one was consuming their standard traditional diet of, you know, seafood and mammals and so on and so forth. And they had low vitamin D because they lived up near the North Pole. There's not enough sunlight. And yet they had no clinical signs of vitamin D deficiency. There was another group, a similar group. However, they had been exposed to a more westernized diet. They had sugar, flour, and so on and so forth in their diet. Same vitamin D levels, exact same blood levels, but the group eating the flour and sugar started to develop signs of vitamin D deficiency, namely things like rickets. So again, you know, you have to sort of look at the person clinically. As a good physician, you would say, what is going on clinically? You saw that first. And what people often do, or what sort of poor physicians do, they'll get the lab work first and they'll say, oh, you must have this disease or you must have this problem. Let me supplement you. Let me do this, without actually assessing what's going on clinically. And that's the exact opposite way you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to do a good history and physical, find out what's going on clinically, and then use supportive data to make those changes. And we sort of skip that step and we just go straight to the labs and the imaging and say, oh, if you, I'm sure, John, if I were to take an MRI of your whole body, I'd find a bunch of shit broken on you, right? As you know it, but it may not bother you. Like, you know, how many people have degenerative disc disease in their back and yet they're totally fine, right? Yep. You know, if everybody that had that went for surgery, I mean, we'd operate on everybody over 40. Pretty much. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of one of those things where we have to really say that. So the short answer is no, we're not seeing any significant deficiencies present themselves.
The last one, visceral fat. One of the myths that I was able to kind of cultivate was that, and I don't even know how this makes sense, but one of the claims was carnivore diet ends up reducing subcutaneous fat, but actually increases visceral fat. And I didn't necessarily know how that mechanism made sense, but that was one of the ones that I was thought that would be an interesting myth buster.
Well, I mean, in my experience, I see a lot of people with, say, for instance, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is a form of visceral fat. That's just too much fat in the liver. That reverses it on carnivore and on a ketogenic diet, for that matter. I mean, there's pretty good data on that. So I don't even know where that rumor came from, because it's not what we see clinically. Now, again, if you consume enough meat and fat to the point where you get fat, and that can occur, I mean, I have seen it happen, then yes, you could probably exacerbate or make worse visceral fat. But I mean, in general, most people consuming food to a reasonable amount are going to see a reduction. In fact, there was just a paper that came out today talking about, now this was a ketogenic diet, high-fat ketogenic diet, dramatically improving non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And so I generally see people reversing their visceral fat on carnivore. I see it, you know, in both lab numbers, which are kind of a proxy, not exact numbers, and certainly with imaging. So, but there's not, the people that might suggest that, and I don't know who they would be, maybe they saw one person that did that, or one or two people where their visceral fat got worse. And so they're saying this is a problem for everyone. I don't realistically think it is.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the amount of misconceptions or things that people attach. Like I said, you know, scurvy, which when I saw that pop up, I was like, man, thinking about, like, you know, Captain Cook and those guys sailing across the Pacific Ocean and showing up and getting fresh vegetables in Hawaii. But it's pretty interesting when you talk to people about eating meat exclusively, how many interesting things get cast towards it when, you know, it just, I don't know. This is one of those things that I can't necessarily identify because I don't sit on the other side of it. So maybe it's a confirmation bias, but I feel like the least destructive, the most humane form of eating is probably eating meat from some pasture raised animal. I mean, we buy a cow at the time. I go down, I see where it lives. I pick the cow out. They take it to the processor, it gets hung. I mean, the impact for that animal and what we're able to feed versus, you know, the typical vegan diet, which is probably the most violent blood soaked diet I've ever come across. I mean, we had a guy that followed our training programs that's a farmer up in North Dakota, and he's like, the amount of small kind of whether it be deer, ground nesting birds, you know, rodents, whatever, he goes, the amount of stuff that I have to pick out of the combine after doing one thing of soy beans, he goes, would make you never want to eat that ever again, for the mere fact that, he goes, it's disgusting, it looks like a bloodbath. So his deal was that the least violent, if your idea is limiting violence towards animals, that the most violent diet that you could consume is actually a vegan diet. It's like the one that's most difficult within the environment. So I'm glad that you're fighting the good fight. It looks good. I do enjoy your social media. The steaks look amazing. So hopefully next time I get to see you, we can film one and crush a big steak.
Sounds good. And maybe next time I'm in Austin or something. So that'd be awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate having me on here.
Anytime, Doc. Thank you. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by kofi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's kofi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See you.